Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and Merry Christmas, and welcome to the second of two Christmas specials of The Political Party, recorded at the Leicester Square Theatre. This one features outspoken Conservative MP Anna Soubry and former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone. As you would expect, it was a wide-ranging interview, taking in not only the events of the year but Brexit, Anna's relationship with her own party, including with MP4 drummer Greg Knight, and on top of that, Ken's career running London, and the comments that had Ken suspended from the Labour Party. There will be no spoilers in this intro. Have a listen and see what you make of them both. But it was just fascinating to sit opposite two people who are big figures in British politics, two with very different experiences, two with very different careers, and see at times how they interacted with each other. They were both fascinating guests, and I hope you enjoy the interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Merry Christmas, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to this political party Christmas special at the Leicester Square Theatre. I'm Matt Ford. It's lovely to see you all here tonight. We've got some phenomenal guests for you tonight. Our first guest tonight is Ramona in Chief. She is one of the most outspoken members of Parliament. She is one of the favourite people that I've ever interviewed here at the political party. It's a delight to have her back. She is the one and only. Please give it up for Anna Soubry.
Anna, you gotta let me know. Should we stay or should we go? Better soft or better hard? No more EU in our backyard. So come on and let us know. Should we stay or should we go?
Anna, welcome to the show.
Good to see you again, darling.
Good to see you again. Good to see you too. You made me all giggly then. That wasn't...
You know what you didn't do? Ask Greg Knight how big is his majority.
I wondered what you were going to say then.
I know, I did do a slight pause.
Having just seen me in the dressing room.
Not in the current climate, mate. Wind it in, fucking...
15,000.
15,000. So Wishart's got 21. You went up to, what did you go up to, Kevin?
11,000. No, sorry, 12,551 approximately.
And I went down.
But your share went up.
Well, I think actually most of us actually polled more in the Tories. We polled more, but... It was a slight problem. Labour polled even more. So my majority, which had gone from 389 in 2010 to 4,200 in 2015, now is now somewhere around about 800.
Yeah, but you still won.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not New Year's Eve. I don't want to get too maudlin. Do you know what I mean?
Like
it's Christmas.
It's fascinating.
You'll be fine on New Year's Eve, then, won't you? I don't want you sitting there.
Yeah, no, I'd be very happy.
What are you doing for Christmas?
Goodbye, 2017.
Yeah, but given the rate at which 2017 got worse than 2016, I'm slightly worried about what's going to happen next year.
Oh, you may well be right. We've got to be optimistic. Sorry, we've got to be optimistic. Smile.
Now, something you might not know is today is Anna's birthday.
Aww.
Happy birthday, Anna. So should we pull a
darling
Christmas cracker and see if you get a present inside?
Okay. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Anna. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you, boys. You're very kind.
And as a special very birthday kind present, we've got you a couple of impact assessments. Well, every Remainer
well,
one.
You found them.
Well,
because they don't exist, apparently.
Well, how frustrating... By the way, what was in your cracker? Was there anything in there?
Know.
Let's have a look. Because they're from Waitrose, so you might have something nice. I was on the floor. Oh, for God. Oh, there you go. Look at that.
Look.
It's a little game.
Oh.
You can roll the dice.
Tiddlywinks, Greg. Sorry.
Sorry, it's sort of saucy panto
vibe. He's going to get me now for that. Sorry.
How frustrating is it for you to be a Conservative MP?
Just generally being a Conservative MP. Just stop there.
Yeah, how frustrating is that?
Well, that's another matter. But go on, no.
And to watch David Davis.
Yeah, he's a fine man. The Brexit bulldog. He's the Brexit bulldog.
Do you get on with him?
Yeah, to be truthful, I don't really know him. I mean, Greg will know him tons better than I will. Because you're almost neighbours, aren't you?
We are neighbours.
Yeah. I mean, I'm being genuine. Right,
he's a miserable
serious.
Bastard.
Oh, I did not see that coming.
I tell you what, I honestly do believe this, right? There'll be people tweeting out now saying, Tory grandee says David Davis is a miserable bastard. Anyway, I think genuinely what's happened, I honestly don't believe he's told any fibs. I actually think he thought there was this thing that was happening, an analysis, and then he's called it an impact assessment, and he's sort of got all excited and all puffed up, and he's gone in front of the select committees, and he's gone, oh, yeah, there's these impact assessments. And he sits like this, and he says, oh, it's all marvellous and everything else. And then when it gets called out by Labour in this brilliant motion that they put forward in the House of Commons, his officials have gone... There aren't any. He's gone, pardon? There aren't any. But I thought there were. No. And the problem is, like Boris, he just doesn't pay any attention to the detail. He just does all the big grandstanding stuff. Because Boris, as we know, doesn't read his brief. Otherwise, he might have known that this woman, who is languishing in a rather unpleasant jail somewhere...
Leslie Zegari Ratcliffe.
Yes. He might have known that, you know, She was there to see her family. Yeah. Small detail, you know, like goes to the whole of her case. He would have known that if he'd actually read his frigging brief, and he clearly hadn't.
No, you said that she was training teachers.
Yes,
which does sound
journalists,
which does sound like code for she is a spy.
Quite, and that was the whole case that has been levied against her. So he was kind of saying, you know what, guys, you're right. When we all know they're miserably wrong.
You might as well
be home with her child and her husband.
I mean, that's what worries the British people, isn't it? Is that
just a bit
that
the foreign secretary doesn't read his brief? Yeah, well, quite concerning, and actually imperils a British citizen. Yeah, pretty fundamental.
How close have you come to leaving the Tory party over it?
It's Greg. That's it, Pete. Kevin, you stand in front of Greg. Well, it is very frustrating. It is frustrating. But then you look at the alternatives and you just get even more frustrated. So you just stay where you are and hope that perhaps some sanity might prevail.
It's hard to see where that sanity is going to come from.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I tell you, I'm being serious, actually. I tell you where it'll come from. It'll come from the British people. Okay, I know we did the referendum thing, which might mean that maybe you can. No, honestly, I shouldn't really say I trust them anymore. No, I do, because the referendum was about a whole stack of other stuff as well.
Yeah.
And we were just rubbish in the Remain campaign. And we got horribly outmaneuvered, and it all came down in the last few weeks of immigration, and it was a complete fuck up, basically. But no, by and large, British people get what they want, actually. And they certainly do in general elections.
You said to me before how frustrating it is having to deal with some of the more vicious elements on the Conservative benches, people who said to you, you know, we'll be after your seat next and all stuff like that, and then...
Is that meant to be Kevin's lot that says that?
Well, yeah, but I was going to ask, do you and Greg ever come to blows?
No, never.
No.
Never. That's because he's never there. No. I'd be really rude to you. I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry.
I was just about to defend you as well.
Oh, well, I'm so sorry.
But I won't.
It was... No, we don't actually. You know why? Because he's an absolutely thoroughly decent human being. So he doesn't play all that nastiness.
Well, steady on. All right. You're now ruining what little of a career I've got left.
But no, I mean, the atmosphere is not great. I mean, actually, not in the House of Commons, because there is a lot of cross-party stuff that happens and cross-party working, especially at the moment with this EU withdrawal bill that's going through. And it's an absolute pleasure to work with people like Chukwuemeka, Chris Leslie. I like Chris Leslie a great deal. He's a Nottingham MP like I am. Stephen Doughty is another really great guy. And then we work with the SNP, work with Steve Geffins. He's a terrific guy. His majority is even smaller than yours, darling, isn't it?
Anna was on my Scottish Affairs Committee, a very assiduous member too.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And she always referred to me as Mr. Wishart.
Mr. Wishart?
Yes.
I always want to call him just like Wishart. It's a great name. It's a great name. You what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I said, I know what Theresa May feels like now, just having you in my committee.
That was good fun. We did have some good fun on that.
So you were on the Scottish Affairs Select Committee?
Yeah, I couldn't find anybody else. And because I once lived in Scotland. And I was once married to somebody who's Scottish.
And that was the first thing Anna told me. I think the only reason I'm on your committee, Pete, is because I was married to somebody who was a Scotsman. So I thought, well, I'll settle for that.
Even then he was only half Scottish. Sorry.
You basically once had a can of Iron Brew. And that.
So have you been north of the border?
Yeah,
you have? Great, get on the committee. No, I have an affinity with Scotland, genuinely. I mean, I am about the only... This is actually true. I think I'm the only English Tory that won an election in Scotland. And I won the... it's the equivalent of being the Chancellor, Rector of Stirling University. I was honorary president, so it's like the rector of the university rather, not the chancellor. And I won it as an English Tory. It was quite bizarre. It was back in 1981, because Jack McConnell, who was the first minister ever of Scotland, reminded me the other day that he and I first met in 1981. And he was elected president, and I was elected honorary president. And that's what really took me to Scotland. And I lived there for about 3 or 4 years and then came back to Nottingham, God's own land.
That's a great place, Nottingham. So when you go back to Nottingham now, what are your constituents saying about the government?
I'm not using language like this in a public place. Just everybody's fed up. They are.
Yeah.
They're fed up with Brexit. Fed up. They just want somebody to come along, provide a nice, safe ship that they with a strong captain on the wheel, with some sort of destination, whether it's Norway or whatever. Everybody can get on board and they can get on with it and stop all this messing about and squabbling. And what is undoubtedly a complete shambles, and it is, it's a mess. It may begin to get sorted out now, but there are very simple solutions to this. It's on the shelf. You can take it down, tweak it a bit, call it Norway. Obviously, I want to sustain the customs union and the single market, but, you know, I'll take Norway or EFTA or something like that. And the real madness of it all is that the majority of MPs would take it as well.
So do you talk to Theresa May at all?
I had a meeting with her in September.
And how did that go?
It's fascinating. Because, it is really, because when you go into number 10 and, you know, you go through certain procedures and, you know, there is a sort of, you're on your best behaviour and everything else, and she was there. But this is before the party conference, of course, and I just think life's not great for her, for all the reasons that you all know about. And I think I think it's been really tough for her. But she's there, and I think she's there genuinely because she feels a sense of duty. Because I don't think she's there for any other reason. She feels, I've taken on this thing, and I've got to see it through now.
And was the meeting about Brexit, or is it just reaching out?
No, Brexit. Yeah, everything's bloody Brexit.
And one-on-one?
No, I went there with the usual suspects that have now grown to be this wonderful band of Brexit mutineers.
Well, that's what the Telegraph called you. They put you on the front page. And it's led to something like 13 death threats coming to your constituency office. I mean, when you saw that front page, what was your initial reaction?
When I first saw it, I think it was somebody on the Labour benches actually who raised it. It might have been Wes Streeting or somebody raised it in the House and said, this is all happening. And then we looked at this and we thought, oh, these photographs are quite interesting because we all seem to be wearing the same colours, which we thought was hilarious. We're all in navy and cream, apart from Ken. Ken's got some funny tie on, and of course he hasn't done up his top button, you know, typical Ken. But they've done it. And it
Ken looked, Clark.
Ken Clark, yeah. No, but they've done it all. There is only one Ken. But they've done it, so it looked like we were all, you know, we all looked really respectable, and it was all beautifully laid out. And there's Sir Oliver Heald. I mean, Oliver Heald. I mean, he is, like Greg Knight, he is a Knight of the Realm. He is a Tory grandee. And there he was as this Brexit mutineers who are going to thwart Brexit, steal your Brexit away from you. And Oliver's gone, oh, I'm getting down with the kids here. It's rather cool. He rather liked it. Oh, it's the most stupid thing that they could possibly have done. Completely backfired. Because now we've become an identifiable group, and in fact, people, and we did this letter yesterday, and now colleagues are coming up and saying, I want to sign the letter. Can I sign it? And suddenly, what started off as a band of about me and Nicky Morgan has now gone to, then went to six, then went to the mutineers who were about 15, and is now 20, and the rest.
And have you got a WhatsApp group called the Mutineers?
No, we should have, actually. One of our numbers found some hideous photographs on pullovers, you know, with sort of swashbucklers on it and all this. So it's completely ridiculous. So, yeah, there's that sort of... But no, we don't have a Mutineers
we should
WhatsApp
do.
Group. No, we have...
Brand it.
Oh, I think we do, actually. I think
you get a bit of merch going.
Yeah, we could do all
you
that.
You could do, yeah, yeah.
No, we did think of... Because, you know, when... In the last Parliament, there were a group of us who used to get told off by the Speaker, Burko.
Yeah, right? Called Rough Trade.
No.
That's what Tim Lawton told me.
No, well, he would do. But no. We were bollocked by Burko.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So we were three Bs, bollocked by Burko. And somebody, I think Simon Burns, had little badges made with three Bs on them. And we wore them, but we didn't dare wear them. We had to wear them inside jackets and things. And sort of flash them at the speaker. It's pathetic, really. But we thought it was hilarious. Bollocked by Burko, three Bs. So we might do some mutiny. We'll go with patches over our eyes and parrots on the shoulder.
It's a good look.
It's a good look, but it could help.
So in the meeting, so you're there with however many mutineers, and is Theresa relaxed in the meeting? Is she awkward?
No.
As usual?
Matt, don't tell anybody. She's never relaxed.
No. So
don't tell anybody, but no.
But did she try and say, hi, guys, God, all this Brexit stuff, anyone want a whiskey?
Now let's think about it.
Yeah.
She keeps herself to herself, and she's quite a private person.
Okay, so what she says, come in, but I'm not going to talk to you.
No, she sort of. No, it's quite interesting because you go in and she's already there, and
yeah,
and she doesn't do the hey, come on in, sit down sort of thing.
Yeah,
and actually, if I may say that, to me says everything about what's gone horribly wrong after the referendum, because what should have happened after the referendum. Was that bit? I was going to do that, but I can't sort this mic. But
I'll hold it for you.
But what she should have done is that, and hugged back in a very divided nation. You know, 48% of those people that voted did not vote for this thing, and that 48% is basically being told to sod off. You are not wanted. You count for nothing. You know, people like my mother, born and bred in Worksop, never lived anywhere else than North Nottinghamshire, is a member of the Liberal metropolitan elite. You know, which part of that did she most take objection to because she voted Remain? Liberal metropolitan. Worksop's a great place, but not exactly, you know, metropolitan elite. I mean, it's outrageous. And that's how people were made to feel. You're nothing and nobody. You're a citizen of nowhere. And you're a lime. Oh, dear Lord. And that's what the big mistake that was made. People should have been hugged back in. Right, guys, let's all come back together and let's make this thing work. But bringing everybody on board and getting something that we can all sign up to.
Just let's take a straw poll on how people voted in the referendum. just to get a sort of litmus test.
Here's a surprise. I wonder what it's going to
give
be.
Me a cheer if you voted Remain. Yay! Give me a cheer if you voted Leave.
Oh, Greg did. Yeah.
Of course, Greg, yeah. Not the most accurate poll, but then which ones
really,
are?
Really, really noticeable. You'll know this. I don't know if you've been up to Nottingham.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean, Nottingham was just out, just leave. It was about 50.5%, maybe 51%. But a big, big difference when you're here in London to what it's like in places like Nottingham and the rest of the country. So there's lots of really, really fed up, angry Remainers in London. But when I go back, when I go home, there are not that many angry Remainers. And actually, it's a feature of Remainers. We are very reasonable, you know, sensible, tolerant people. No, seriously. And I think, you know, that there has been an acceptance. And that was the thing about the general election. I don't know what the other boys found. Was in the general election, the people were saying, look, you know, this has been this vote. Now we've got to get on and do it, but we've got to do it in the right way. So there weren't that many angry... Certainly in Broxtow, there weren't that many angry Remainers.
Now, I mean, do you think there is something in that? Is there... maybe it's not for me to say, but, you know, are centrists, you know... are Blairites just more reasonable, sensible, more intellectual people?
Now, you see, you kind of spoilt it now by using the B word.
Do you think that's tarnished?
I think we're really honest about this. And no, if you voted Leave, you are not an extremist by any means. Because lots of people who are completely sensible, reasonable people voted Leave.
And people like Greg.
And people like Greg Knight voted Leave. No. So, but I think in British politics at the moment, let's be very honest about this, you have got the two main parties, one definitely in the hands of the absolute extreme, which is Corbyn and his merry gang. And then you've got a Tory party that, if we're not careful, will drift to another extreme. And the argument that I make is that there are millions and millions of people at the moment who actually don't feel any political party represents them.
Yeah.
That is really bad, and that's not right.
So does that mean, if the two parties don't budge, that we need something else?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen with it. Look, I'll be very blunt about the Labour Party, right? There's a whole load of perfectly sensible, great young people that have gone and joined for £3 the Labour Party, and a lot of them are Remainers. And at some point, they are going to wake up to the harsh reality that Jeremy Corbyn is not going to deliver Remain. He's a proper old leftist who was always opposed to our membership of the old common market and all the rest of it. That's why he only gave, 7.5 out of 10. He's a Brexiteer. He's always been a Brexiteer. And there's a lot of these youngsters who are going to be, hopefully, we're going to wake up and be hugely disabused of the idea that he is going to deliver Remain. If he's going to do anything, he would have delivered Brexit. You know, it's the Kevin Brennans of this world. Don't tell him I said this, but, you know, these are the sensible Labour people, and they would do a bloody good job of making sure that we got something sensible.
Bloody hell.
I know, it's the end of his career. You actually have to be quite careful about, you know, paying people compliments at the moment in the Labour Party, because they're terrified of getting deselected by momentum.
Kevin, of course, is a shadow minister as well.
Is he? Oh, shit. Sorry, Kevin.
I was. No, I still am. Yeah.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Well, remember, I shadowed you for a while.
You did. You were very good. Too bloody good for my liking.
So what were you... Was Kevin like as an opponent across the dispatch
box? He's a complete bugger.
In what way?
Because he's very good at it. And so he gives you a hard time. And
did it ever get personal between you?
No, not at all. I mean, we were at the time, there was a lot of problems with the steel industry. And I was just, and fairness to Anna, I think she was trying to do her job as a minister, but it was my job to hold her feet to the fire put pressure on her and to make sure we saved Port Talbot Steelworks.
Especially
in the end we did. So yeah. It was, you know, that's what politics is all about.
It was a huge achievement, that, actually. Yeah.
I have to say, as someone who enjoys pragmatism in politics and people having friends in other parties, that was a very disappointing answer. I really wanted there to be beef there. But you're both too pleasant for that, aren't you?
No, I think the thing was, actually, on the steel crisis, was that David Cameron made it absolutely clear that Port Talbot was not closing. And there was this magic moment. Have I told you this story?
I'm not sure.
No, there was this magic moment when there was... I don't repeat anything.
I haven't heard it yet.
When we were sitting, there used to be this sort of brains sort of storming thing.
Yeah. A meeting.
No. But this was where we were really trying to find solutions to this real problem with Port Talbot. And my line was always, just buy it. Buy it for a quid. And we'd been up this hill and down this dell trying to find a solution to this real problem with Port Talbot and it's securing its future. And I said, I'm sorry, guys, I'm going to have to say it. Buy it for a quid. At which point, Oliver Letwin, who's to chair this meeting, went, well, I think she could be right, actually. I think we should buy it for a quid.
I've got a quid.
At which point, Greg Hands, who was at that point, he was very big in the Treasury, he just went, I've never seen a man's face actually drain of blood. And he just went, have I just actually heard it suggested and agreed we might buy a steelworks for £1? And Oliver went, oh, yeah, you're right, absolutely. Maybe we shouldn't be doing that. But, I mean, with these, all these things were genuine options that we discussed.
Nationalisation?
Yeah, who would have thought it?
So does that mean,
absolutely right there. Absolutely.
Does that mean that David Cameron's more left-wing than Jeremy Corbyn?
No, I think he was he understood the value. I'm not answering that. He understood the value of the steel industry to the country, genuinely. And so we got the deal in Scunthorpe, and that was brilliant, because he'd said he didn't want Scunthorpe to go. But Port Talbot was just like, that is a, you know, use this awful phrase, red line. That is a red line. Port Talbot is not going to close. It was brilliant. And it hasn't, and it's doing well, isn't it, Ken? It's all right then, all right, okay.
Fingers crossed, yeah, so far.
No, but just, it's amazing.
We're not out of the woods yet.
I love the fact he was too engaged there, having a beer. Already on it.
Typical.
These Labour boys.
Drinking beer. Far too normal.
What's your tipple of choice?
Well, actually, this red wine, I don't often drink red wine, but that is gorgeous. That's from
the House Red.
Merlot. It's a Merlot.
Highly recommended. It is a Christmas show. I should have asked you, have you put your Christmas tree up yet?
No, it's coming tomorrow. It'll go up tomorrow, and okay. I shall decorate it on Saturday with my other half, who would undoubtedly abolish Christmas. You know, he's out there somewhere.
You're going out with Oliver Cromwell?
Honestly. You know that line in... Robin?
Don't take him to Ireland, fuck.
How sad and sick do you think Tories really are, Matt? But, no, you know that line in Robin Hood? When he goes, the sheriff goes, well, cancel Christmas. That's what Neil would do, cancel Christmas.
No.
I know, it's awful, isn't it?
Why doesn't he like Christmas? He's from Loughborough.
Says it. Says
it. It doesn't really happen there, does
it? Yeah, it does. He's a Forest fan, though.
Oh, good on him. Oh, there you go. There's one tree
there's
that he likes.
There's the other one.
Yeah.
Oh,
excellent. There's a few Forest fans in tonight.
No, I've become a lifelong supporter of Notts County.
Don't say this shit, because you told me you were a Forest fan a few years ago.
No, I do. I will. In fact,
it's going to get you in trouble, you know.
We haven't watched Forest since they played Leeds. And you know the song, One of Your Own?
Yeah.
And all the Forest fans were singing, One of Your Own.
Yeah. He's one of your own.
He's one of your own. That Jimmy Savile, he's one of your own.
Yeah, I wasn't at that game.
And I was at the game when they played Derby. Yeah, and the Forest fans got the sheep's heads and threw them into the pubs in Derby.
Yeah, I mean,
there
were a few guys who are not representative of the Forest movement as a whole. I think most people who know Forest fans know that they are peaceful people, that Forest is a creed of peace, and they are not. They use our name to radicalise other people.
Yeah, they're all old men as well.
They are.
That's the other thing.
But there is,
and they're the worst.
There is YouTube
footage.
But now,
you've got to come to Meadow Lane. You've got to come and see County. County, go back down to County, and you get all these people now, and they're all going, hey, what's going on? We're bloody winning. What do we do? Because they are winning. I watched them for 5 years. I never saw them win once.
No.
And now you go along and they're winning. You can see all the fans sort of sitting there going, we bloody won again. What are we going to do? Honestly,
I'm very pleased for them.
Absolutely brilliant.
I'm delighted for them. But it is kind of like the Lib Dems. I want them to do well to a point.
They're going up.
Well, they're doing very well.
No,
you mentioned
they're going to go up. Really
well, I hope they do.
No, it's brilliant.
I hope they do. I want them it's almost like being an England fan when Wales are doing well. You want them to do well, but not against us. As well as, but no better. That's fair enough, isn't it?
No.
But how do you feel towards England then, Kev, when there's a, you know...
Well, it's not my team, is it?
Okay, but you'd want... For English friends, you'd want England to do well in a World Cup, wouldn't you?
It's not my team, really.
Fucking hell! Oh, my God. Well, I've never... such division tonight.
Just as well they didn't ask me that.
Oh, now that's who you should really ask.
Oh, fuck that right up. I should have gone straight to Pete. Well, you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn earlier. And, of course, Jeremy Corbyn's politics are under the microscope like never before. And there was a sense that there's a genuine desire, maybe a mass movement, who desire left-wing politics. Of course, our next guest is someone who, when he ran the JLC and stood for City Hall, was arguably the most prominent and powerful left-wing politician in Britain for a very long time. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ken Livingstone. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Just before we do proceed with Ken...
When are we opening the wine?
Oh, well, they're gifts for the audience, but if anyone would like to win a half-drunk bottle of Tanglefoot later... ladies and gentlemen, just before we do proceed, MP4 are going to leave us, but they're going to come back later in the show to play us out. So please, just for now, give it up for the wonderful MP4! Ken, welcome to the show. We've been talking about Jeremy Corbyn, no doubt. You heard some of that conversation backstage. Do you think he is more than likely going to be our next Prime Minister?
Yes, I do. I mean, actual fact, if you look back, I was wandering around doing endless bloody meetings and interviews on radio and TV from the moment he got elected leader, saying I thought he could win the next election. Everyone thought I was mad. But I've been through the same thing. When I became the leader of the GLC, the night I became the leader of the GLC, Thatcher made a speech in Scotland saying I was going to impose on Londoners the sort of tyranny the people of East Europe live under. A few months later, when we cut the fares by 30%, the Daily Mail said this was the first step towards a full communist economy. And Tory Central Office was briefing the press that I'd been at a gay bar in the East End where I'd been buggered by six men in succession. So my poll ratings went down to about 18%. But then 3 years later, they had to abolish the GLC election because we were heading towards a landslide.
Anna Soubry's ears have pricked up.
Well, I hope to God it's not true.
It's only five. But bear in mind, back in 1981, that wasn't the vote winner it would be today.
No. don't know what to say, Ken. But there is a sense, though, that whatever you would call it, the hard left, maybe that's not a phrase that you would use, but Nick Clegg was here last night saying, you know, this is fantasy economics. You know, Jeremy Corbyn and people like John McDonnell and yourself are making these promises that they know could never be delivered. I mean, do you think, actually, if Corbyn was really ambitious, he could turn Britain into, say, a socialist state?
Well, look, I mean, what Jeremy is saying is what I've been saying all my political career and John McDonnell. The key to economic success isn't cutting taxes on the rich or on giant corporations, isn't smashing the unions, it's investing. And if you actually look, that post-war period, the Labour government under Attlee set a real programme of public sector investment that modernised their infrastructure, attracted private sector investment. And by 1973, because when the Tories got in, they carried on with that policy, we had our highest level of investment ever, 20% of our economy going into investment. Germany was doing better, they did 25%. And then when Thatcher came to power, she changed all that. But we look back at it now. Are we better off today than we were then? So many people have been left behind. So many, 6 million jobs or 8 million, I can't remember now, wiped out in manufacturing. And people voted for Brexit because they're angry. I mean, I grew up in a world where everything got better all the time. No one can say that today. But the key is investment. And if you actually look, Crossrail, which will open in about a year's time, didn't keep to the timetable. When I had to get the Labour government to give me £5 billion to start building that, I could actually prove that the increase in taxes coming in after it was built would be three times that. And that's the key to investment. It puts people into work. It makes your economy more efficient. Our economy is limping along pathetically. That's why the Tories almost lost the election. If they'd lost seven more seats, Jeremy would be in Downing Street.
Well, Anna, obviously, ideologically, you disagree, I presume, with what Ken's saying. But is there any of that that, as a Conservative, you agree with, that you do actually need a level of, say, capital expenditure by the state to drive growth?
We do, and that's why we're putting all the billions of pounds that we are. We're investing in our railways on a scale that's not been since the Victorian times. So HS2 is coming, as you know. Through Toton, that will be where the East Midlands Hub will be in my constituency. And what's bizarre is that Ken's breed of Labour are opposed to HS2, the biggest investment, a new line that will link the great cities, especially in the north, and from the Midlands up to the north.
I'm in favour of HS2.
Oh, but yeah, I wish you'd tell Dennis, because Dennis Skinner's opposed to it.
Yeah, because the north isn't getting... I mean, London's got quite... One of the reasons London's economy has grown dramatically, and, I mean, about another 2 million people have moved here in the last 20 years, is because we got more investment than anywhere else in Britain. I got billions out of the Labour government, a massive expansion of our transport system, 8,000 new buses, all the investment in the Olympics. But if you're up in the north, people have been talking about that new railway line from Liverpool to Manchester to Leeds and York for, I think, 50 bloody years.
Yeah, but that's a different... That obviously goes across Pennine, and you're right. East-west is always a problem. Yeah. If you're over in places like King's Lynn or you're in Norwich, there's always a problem east-west. Mm. I'm talking about HS2, which absolutely delivers a brand new line that will link London to Birmingham, then to Sheffield and Leeds, and obviously on the west coast, the other part of the Y. And I'm afraid a load of your guys are very much opposed to it.
Well, I think if you're a Northern MP, you just feel...
Well, when you say Northern, Dunnage, you mean north of Watford?
No, I mean anywhere near Dennis Skinner.
He's in Derbyshire.
Well, it's not anything north of Watford, really.
Yeah.
So, loving the train chat.
I'm into trains.
But...
I'm into trains, heavily.
Does Ken not make an interesting point about Brexit? But there's
a sense
of...
Oh, no, Brexit...
But about anger...
I love this idea. I heard this from somebody else who said, oh, Brexit was all... It was a vote against austerity. And I said, no, really? Not in the real world, mate. Let me take you to parts of my constituency. It's nothing to do with bloody austerity. It, as you know, Matt, the biggest... driver for most Leave voters, especially, you know, I keep saying this to people, look at the result in Nottingham, and the biggest Leave areas were white, predominantly white working class areas, but it was about immigration. And then, you know, you go to Mansfield, you go to Ashfield, these are places, you know, huge vote for Leave, and it was a vote about immigration. How many immigrants have they got in places like Mansfield, Kirkby and Sutton in Ashfield? Probably about five. I'm not exaggerating. In the areas where there are the least number of immigrants, that was the biggest Leave vote. And that's one of the reasons why in London, people in London voted Remain, because you know the huge benefits that immigration has conveyed on this great city.
But the point I was going to make was that Ken made a point about anger, and actually...
There was anger.
But I was going to make a point about Jeremy Corbyn. Isn't the sort of state of play at the moment a symptom of the fact that people are angry, they feel the world is unfair, and actually the Tories... aren't really alive or awake or seem to be listening to people in the same way
that Jeremy
Corbyn
is. I don't use the word angry, but I think what Jeremy did do was that he offered people a vision and his vision of hope. He offered people hope. No debate about that. And the huge mistake that was made in the Conservative Party campaign was, A, it didn't talk about the economy and the achievements, and then it didn't set out a vision. I mean, and even something like actually providing two... free school dinners for the least well-off kids in our society somehow got translated to the fact we were going to cut free school dinners. That's what a crap campaign we ran. So, no, it's true. And we didn't offer people a vision of hope. We didn't offer anything positive, just like the Remain campaign. The Remain campaign was hugely defensive. There was nothing positive about it. We never spoke positively about the huge brilliance of the benefits of being a member of the EU.
William Hague made a point when I interviewed him a few months ago, and he said...
name dropper.
He said, name dropper. He was against ourselves. I ran his house.
It was very good. I'm impressed.
Sure, he's a friend of the show. he said, well, you very rarely fight the same election twice. But that's a good point, isn't it? Isn't this the point that Corbyn maybe has had a high watermark, Ken, but the conditions won't be as favourable again?
Well, I think they'll be more favourable because the economy is limping along. We've just seen these bloody great fare increases are coming on the railway, whilst our wages are dripping on, you know, just over 1% increase a year. I mean, literally, nothing between now and the next election is going to see the economy getting better. So people are going to be even more angry at the next election. And I think you're right, you had a crap campaign. But that was largely because, at the beginning, the Tory party assumed it was going to be a landslide. I mean,
believed
all this
crap. Well, we knew the polls, that's why.
Well, but the polls...
Can I just tell you, in my real world, we had the county council elections And so I knew what was going on the doorstep because I'm one of those that goes out, knocks on the door, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And we were doing really, really, really well. And the real story was that we did have that. There was a genuine lead there and we threw it away. That was the real story. And it was there and we
The local elections just, you know, 6 weeks before went very well for the Tories.
Extremely well.
But the moment you hit the general election, the law requires radio and TV have to give them equal coverage. And Jeremy's able to set his agenda. And we were focusing on the things he was doing. Before that, we'd had 18 months of endless interviews about, are you going to wear a white poppy? Are you going to bow to the Queen? I mean, we weren't able to get across the economic strategy that Jeremy was talking about.
No, you were lucky that people didn't actually know and understand your economic strategy, because if they did, they wouldn't vote for you.
I mean, it connected with people.
That's a different matter. As a human being, absolutely, I agree. Mm. And I think the thing that did happen was that one of the big mistakes was that, you know, and I put my hands up to this, so, because I wrote, and I always write my own literature, but I, you know, I wrote this thing about Jeremy Corbyn's, John McDonnell's links, with the IRA. And of course, for a whole swathe of our population, that meant absolutely nothing. In fact, IRA meant that guy who died, who shook the Queen shook his hand, Arthur McGuinness. So, you know, stuff like that just didn't resonate. And the more that people saw of Jeremy, he actually grew. I mean, this is a guy who's been on the back benches. The biggest decision he's ever had to make in his political career is, you know, what will the veggie option be at the meeting, the annual meeting of the Islington Labour Party? And genuinely, that is a fact. He's never been a shadow minister or anything else. That is a fact. And but I mean, he obviously just put his tie on before he came in the chamber, and he always used to be in the back up there, and he'd ask some obscure question about the Outer Mongolian basket weavers or whatever, and it suddenly became, well, it's your turn to become, you know, the hard left candidate for the leadership of the Labour Party. Oh, all right, Diane won't do it, I'll do it, and fuck me, he goes and wins, and actually, to be totally fair to him, he has grown into the position. And he has. And my story, my perfect example of all of this, of how bad it all was that the One Show, okay, I'm not a regular viewer of the One Show, I held my hands up to that, but Theresa May goes on the One Show with Philip May, and they talk about boys' jobs, at which point at least, what, three-quarters of the audience goes, what the? Boys' jobs? 2017? Boys' jobs putting out the bins? And they look a bit, well, Philip and Theresa. And what does Jeremy Corbyn do when he goes on? He goes on and says, I've got this jam. I made it. I grow stuff on my allotment and I've got a jar of my jam. Would you like it? And at that point, everybody goes, oh, what a lovely guy. Isn't that lovely? And that just says everything about the personality side of the campaign. And he looked, I mean, most people don't make their own jam from the allotment, but he looked like a warm, rather cuddly, elderly uncle with his jar of jam.
Can I just say, I mean, years ago, me and my wife were at a St. Patrick's Day dinner, and Jeremy was on our table. And on the way home, my wife said, that's the nicest man I've ever met in my life. And he is genuinely...
I bet you're a bit pissed off about that.
Look, no one's ever accused me of being nice. Look at all the people I had to eliminate.
She's your wife, love.
But Anna makes a good point, doesn't she, about the way in which
people have campaigned
against Jeremy Corbyn. That, and you raise the question of some of the company that people have kept. And, people say it's a distasteful company, but, you know, the IRA defend their right to talk to John McDonnell. And they have that right. I mean, Ken, you were one of the people in the 80s that was talking to Sinn Féin and talking to Gerry Adams, deeply controversial at the time. Obviously, we know that peace was achieved through Good Friday. But at the time, what you were doing was very controversial.
Oh, God, I got death threats, I'd be attacked. But you're back. What was happening in 1981, about twice a year there'd be a horrific bomb go off in London, i.e. killing lots of Londoners. And Thatcher's line was, we're not going to talk to the IRA because it's not about politics, they're just psychopaths and criminals. And when I met Gerry Adams, I mean, he immediately said, this is about 1982, 83, I mean, we know we can never defeat the British Army, but you can't defeat us either. When the British Army shoots a couple of IRA members, we get another 20 people apply to join. And we know there's got to be a negotiation. So back in 82, Adams was saying, we're prepared to sit down and negotiate. Thatcher wouldn't deal with that. And I suppose perhaps Blair's biggest achievement, because he came to this without any background about politics in Ireland. He just saw it as a problem, brought people together and resolved it. And it's been, I think, his best legacy.
In terms of the criticism that people level at Jeremy is that, yes, he definitely did talk to Gerry Adams and others, as you did before it was fashionable, for want of a better word. But one of the criticisms that's levelled at him is that he was only talking to one side, that actually people like you and Jeremy almost were on the side of the Republican movement.
I mean, basically, Jeremy's got a substantial, or did have, I suspect it's not so large now, but a substantial Irish Catholic community in his constituency. I did in mine. And I knew the discrimination that Irish Catholics in Northern Ireland were suffering. It was not as bad as the way blacks were treated in the Deep South in the 50s and 60s, but it was discrimination. And the first time I went there to meet Gerry Adams, and I was wandering around West Belfast, and I was stunned. It was like Britain after the war. It was so squalid and run down. And so it was about politics. It was about discrimination. And what's amazing is there'd been such a long period of time before the violence started.
Yeah, they were blowing people up. That's what they did.
Yeah, and they did. And if they
murdered people.
And you either stopped
innocent
them.
People.
And also, we were murdering some people. I met British soldiers who were in the...
The British soldiers were taken in to defend the Catholic community. That, in 68, when the soldiers went in, it was to defend the Catholic community.
That's why they were sent in. Yeah. But then you had things like the killing of the Miami Show Band, the most popular band in Ireland. A British officer, Captain Narek, led a group of Ulster units.
You can't defend the IRA.
I'm just telling you this. In a war, terrible things are done on both sides. He led people over at the border. They stopped the car the Miami Show Band was in. They shot them dead. And they did that because this is 1975. Right wing were worried that if Wilson had negotiated a deal, he'd have called another election and actually got a working majority.
See, the trouble is with you, Ken, you always make everything into simplistic political terms. Mm. And actually what you strip out of that is the human side of things.
Well, I think killing pop stars is a pretty...
You cannot defend the IRA. Nobody can ever defend the IRA.
I don't defend them.
No, well, it sounds like it.
What I denounce, though, is the fact that...
You met them. You didn't go and meet the Protestant families that were being... You only had to listen to Lady Herman's speech the other day in Parliament, who was talking about innocent farmers who would open their barn door and find that they got their heads blown off by this bunch of murdering thugs. They were that, and they were psychopathic. The man who was... And what turned it for me was Ian Paisley, because I thought, I'd never had an awful lot of time for this, not surrender and all, I'm not into all of that shit. But when he said he could forgive them, I thought, if he could forgive them, I will follow that, because my generation, we didn't live in Ireland, but we saw a lot of this horror, and it was very, very, very real for us because it was on our TV screens.
I'm not defending anyone killing anyone. I'm denouncing the fact that we went through decades where we could have done a peace deal and the killing could have stopped sooner. Because I remember each year, back in the early 90s, I used to be invited to go to the Army Training College down at, I can't remember where it is now, and I would do a speech about my approach to the Irish problem. Then there'd be a Conservative or an Ulster Unionist MP give their side. And the officers would get up and they would tear apart the Conservatives, saying, why won't you negotiate with the IRA? Why are my men being killed? Because you refuse to talk. And that's what I denounce. I mean, when Gerry Adams met Jeremy Corbyn and me in the early 80s and said he was prepared to negotiate, if the government had done that then, 1,000 less lives would have been lost. 1,000 more people would died on both sides because the British government wouldn't negotiate. And Blair got in, it was all over in a couple of years.
I thought
it was supposed to be a light-hearted
thing. Well, yeah, well, it's light-hearted in places and serious in others, and it's fine to have a mix. When you met Jerry Adams for the first time, I mean, is he an intimidating individual?
No, I mean, he's quite a normal guy. I mean, there's nothing particularly, no amazing sort of part of his personality or psychology or anything like that. I mean, he was a kid who'd grown up in a pretty grim community and got caught up. Don't get, until the Protestant police in Northern Ireland started rioting, which you mentioned, and troops went in. Up until then, it had just been a really quite grim but quiet. It wasn't violence.
But there have been gangsters as well. We're quite apart from the sectarian element of it. Did you not think, fucking hell, I'm prepared to meet some people, but this guy's a bit far?
I mean, if you're in politics, you have to meet some pretty appalling people all over the place. I mean, if you're in government, you have to negotiate with some psychopaths.
You weren't in government, and did you meet all these horrible extreme Protestants who were also embarked upon a reign of terror as well? Well, did you meet them?
Well, no, because in actual fact, they took a decision to assassinate me, so that wouldn't have been a good idea.
You see how it works out. It's funny, isn't it? Because the left always meet these particular groups. You never meet the other side.
Well, from the moment
like
I became
the Hamases of this
world. From the moment I became an MP, I actually got on very well with Paisley. He actually got up and defended me after my maiden speech.
I don't think Ian Paisley was somebody who was planting bombs under people's cars.
No,
it?
But a lot of people.
Do you think Jerry Adams was?
The question is: were you just going to sit there and allow that to go on for decades more? Or were you going to try and bring it to an end?
But you didn't. The person who brought it to an end, as you rightly identify, was actually Blair. I mean, and others, and John Major, who actually laid down this groundwork.
I wanted to stop the bombings in London. We were getting two horrific bombings a year in the early 80s. And I mean, just going to sit there and do nothing about it?
What did you do? Did you say to him, Jerry, can I give you a tip, mate? Stop bombing London.
No, I listened to him saying he was prepared to negotiate and end the violence. We came back and we said that. We made it clear to the public. And Thatcher just turned her back.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
On it.
You rightly said that it's one of Tony Blair's greatest achievements. You and Tony Blair obviously have a checkered history. We were never lovers. Outmanoeuvred you in 2000 for the nomination to be Labour's candidate for London Mayor. You then outmanoeuvred him by becoming London Mayor. And then in the end, you kind of agreed for the sake of the Labour Party that you could be a Labour London Mayor, which you won in 2004. A lot of people say that actually during the period that he was Prime Minister and you were London Mayor, you were both pragmatists and had quite a sort of positive working relationship.
We never talked about the war or anything like that. We just, in all our meetings, we talked about things we agreed on. Like, I wanted to, get massive investment and turn London's economy around. I wanted to, tackle a lot of the problems like falling police numbers.
He wanted Jerry Adams' phone number.
He'd already sorted that out before I became mayor. And literally, that was the thing. I mean, he was amazed once when, having brought me back into the party, we were launching my re-election campaign, and it was, I was announcing we were going to put police patrolling the streets again, which, we hadn't had for years. And he was amazed. He completely agreed with that. And, of course, police patrolling streets prevents crime. and crime numbers fell quite dramatically. And I mean, sadly, of course, that's largely all been cut back now. They're not there anymore, and crime's going up.
So Blair has become a sort of figure to react against on the left. The guy who's reacted against him most and has sort of channeled that is Jeremy Corbyn. He's an old friend of yours. There's plenty of old photos of you together back in the old GLC days. John McDonnell was your deputy on the GLC. How close a friend is he?
Well, I mean, literally, once I became mayor and gave up my parliamentary seat, I mean, I was out of parliament, so I was out of touch. And being mayor was pretty much 24/7.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, I'm about the only politician that has ever inherited nothing. I mean, normally when you get elected as a council leader or prime minister, there's a machine that's been there for a century or more. Yeah. I got elected, there was nothing. All the people who run the GLC were dead or retired. And that first term was actually creating the new machine.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it's amazing. But it did mean, I mean, I remember those press complaints, we haven't seen the mayor, what's he doing, and so on. Well, interviewing lots of buggers to do the job, actually.
In terms of your legacy, people will always say the congestion charge. That was, as London mayor, that was a totemic policy. It lasts, it probably always will. Millions of people have benefited from better air quality. Air quality, obviously, is a big issue now for Sadiq. What are the things, as London mayor, you wish you'd gone further on or done differently?
Well, actually, the mayor had very... I mean, Blair was very nervous about this. So the mayor of London, when I was elected, had about one-tenth the powers the mayor of New York has. And when I was brought back into the party, I persuaded Blair we should give the mayor more powers. So I persuaded him to remove the clause in the mayoral bill that had said the mayor will have no responsibility for education, social services or housing. I said the mayor should have responsibility for housing. And so law came in giving lots more powers to the mayor, and the key one of that was housing. But it only came in from the point of the third election in 2008, which is the one I lost. And I persuaded Gordon Brown to give me £5 billion. We're going to start building council housing again. Boris didn't spend a bloody penny on it. So that's, I think, the real tragedy of losing that election. We'd have had a proper housing programme by now.
How hard was it losing to Boris Johnson?
Well, very depressing because many of the key appointees I'd made were sacked by Boris and so on. And then he had to carry on things which are contractually committed, like Crossrail and so on. But the only thing that wasn't contractually committed that he didn't cancel, and there's a new London Bridge coming, there were extensions of the trains and the tubes and things like that. But the only thing he didn't cancel was the bike scheme.
Yeah.
But then the stupid man, instead of just taking the relatively cheap Paris scheme, went and got one from somewhere in Canada, which bloody sight more expensive.
Does it rankle you that they're called Boris bikes?
I couldn't give a sod. I didn't come into politics because I wanted to be some popular figure. I came into politics because I wanted to do things.
Oh, come on. No, every politician's got an ego.
It's the difference between ego and actually just wanting to be forever in the bloody media. Mm. I mean, I think what's interesting about Boris was that when he got elected, I thought, here's this a new version of Thatcher. Hardline right wing is going to send a new agenda. And he really hasn't. Yeah, it turns out he's not really a politician at all. He should have gone into show business.
Right. Boris is not right wing.
No. And that's why all that talk about he's going to be the next Tory leader, I mean, most Tory MPs realise that he's not worth having.
No. Boris has blown up big time.
Yeah.
Boris has always been socially liberal. In fact, I went to this dinner today lunch today with George Osborne, who told a story that just after he got elected, my party, very ashamed of this, was doing things whereby there was, first of all, do you remember all that stuff about, what was it, Clause 28?
Section 28. The Local Government Act.
Dreadful, absolutely awful, which positively discriminated against gay people, right? Anyway, mercifully we finally got rid of it. Mm. But there was, I think it must have been, I don't know who it was, but anyway, Labour put forward an amendment or something or other to say that gay people should be able to adopt children. Mm. And the Tory party said, no, this is absolutely appalling. And there'll be a three-line whip. And George said there were three MPs that said, we are not going to obey this three-line whip. We're going to vote with the Labour Party. We feel really strongly about them. And who were the three? and they were told, you will have no political career if you vote against this three-line whip. George Osborne, David Cameron and Boris Johnson. So Boris has always been socially liberal. Mm. He just lost the plot when he chose the wrong side on the referendum, and he chose it for his own political advantage.
He didn't really believe in it.
No, he didn't believe in it. Mm. Absolutely. And that's why I think for loads of people, at that moment they thought, no, absolutely no. They walked away from him because they knew that he blatantly chose Leave for his own purposes, which was to become the next leader. Mm. And his big shock was that they went and bloody won.
Well, their faces the morning after.
His face said it all.
Oh, yeah.
Ashen-faced in the face of victory. Ken, did you talk to him much during the campaign? What was your relationship like with him?
You had endless debates, so we would chat and so on. He'd occasionally get angry with me and so on.
What for?
I'd be really rude about what he was saying and pin him down and things like that. But after he won the second election, after he beat me the second time, he said, I want to take you out for a meal. And he took me to a local restaurant near where he lives, chatting about, you know, what I thought about this and that. And I thought, this is wonderful. I'd spend the whole time telling him he's got to start a house building program. But all he wanted to talk about was why I'd failed to become Prime Minister. And he was kept saying, yeah, because he obviously...
Why you had or why he had?
No, why I hadn't. Because I think he was saying, I'll make sure I don't repeat Ken's mistakes, you know. And that was the whole bloody evening. Why didn't you become Labour leader? Why didn't you become Prime Minister?
And what advice did you give him?
I just said, there's not much you can do. I was rising up in the Labour Party just as it was starting moving to the right. And Kinnett adopted a sort of lighter version of Thatcher's policies for the 92 election, changed the rules. So, I mean, before Kinnett changed the rules, any Labour MP could stand for the leadership. But when Tony Benn stood against him, he changed the rules so you had to get 20% of MPs. And, fortunately for Jeremy, by the time that election came out, it had been reduced to 15%. He could just get in, but I had no chance. 20% of MPs, Labour MPs, were never going to vote for me.
No, well, we didn't think 15% were going to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And 80% of the 15% probably wish they hadn't. But
until the last election.
Well, still. We'll see what happens. But there's this scene. What restaurant are you in where there's Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson sat down? The other diners must have thought you were lookalikes.
It's just a local Turkish restaurant. Nothing extravagant.
Well, I know, but did no one say, fucking hell, that's Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson?
No.
So he sat there. What did he have?
Oh, God, I can't remember what he had to eat.
I'm trying to sort of picture
too
it.
Too much, I should imagine.
But he sat there going, Ken, I have great respect for what you did, and I have great respect for your career. I would like to be Prime Minister. I just, bloody well, I'm trying to, I have two more cobras, please. I'm trying to understand, Ken. Come on, old chap, you help me out here. How do I become... how do I get through that bloody front door? Whatever. Was he as brazen as that?
Yes. Actually, you must have been there watching us. But no, I just wanted to talk about housing. And the other thing that pissed me off about Boris, that after the congestion charge worked so well and pollution dropped by about 12%, just before I lost the election to Boris in 2008, we'd introduced the low emission zone. Because we wanted to reduce all the pollution from heavy goods, vehicles and things like that. And the first stage had come in, but then Boris just stopped all the others. Otherwise, if he'd carried on by now, we wouldn't have 4,000 Londoners dying every year because of the air quality.
Is it almost like...
Oh, 40,000, is it? I can't remember.
Too many, anyway. Yeah. Is it almost like American presidents, where actually London mayors are in a very small club, and you ring each other for advice? There's a Labour mayor now. Has Sadiq ever come to you for advice on anything?
I mean, basically, he's broadly carried on with he's revived the policies. He's got a problem, though. I mean, I got elected as a Labour government was starting to increase public spending. I mean, he's got the problem of the Tory government that's cut local government spending by 40%. So, I mean, he's trying to do all the right things, but he's not going to get this government to give him a load of money to build housing.
But is there a kind of former mayor's support group where the three of you will just, you know, say this is how you sort that out, Sadiq?
Each mayor comes in and brings in a team of people around them who then run the machine with them. It's not like Parliament at all.
No.
This is the thing. Blair was in love with America and everything. I mean, he'd much rather have been born in America and run for president. And so the mayoral system he imposed on London was the American system of an elected executive, whereas prime ministers and council leaders preside over a civil service structure that runs it. But no, as mayor, you have to bloody run it. I loved it.
The building itself was iconic, the City Hall. You said that it looked like a glass testicle.
Well, yeah, it's an odd shape, wasn't it? Let's be honest. it's fine. I didn't care about... I actually loved the old GLC building, County Hall. That was absolutely... the Tories built that. I just think it's a tragedy that, you know, we couldn't get that back.
You were not just opposing the people that you were standing against in the GLC, you became a talismanic opponent of Margaret Thatcher in a way that perhaps even the Labour leaders at the time weren't, and that sort of both sides of the, you know, across the side of the river with a banner on the side. The GLC was abolished in 1986, did you shed a tear?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was painful. Because so many people lost their jobs, and all the good things we were doing, you know, like boosting public transport, all that came to an end. But, the defining thing about that period was that I would never have emerged if the Tory party hadn't started depicting me as this dangerous communist sympathiser and all of that. I mean, previous GLC leaders, no one had ever heard of them. I mean, the wave of attacks on me lifted my profile up massively. But the other thing, I was quite happy to take on Thatcher because I thought what she was doing was terrible. But I noticed Labour MPs had a real problem coping with a woman attacking her. I mean, I just didn't think our opposition was very good under Michael Foot or under Neil Kinnock in actually taking on Thatcher, frankly.
And you and Thatcher really were the spitting image puppets of the time in a way in the people's minds.
No, they did have spitting image puppets of us, yes.
Did you ever talk to her directly? Did you ever have many conversations with
Margaret
Thatcher?
She never met me at all when I was GLC leader. And it was only when I got into Parliament. I mean, she wouldn't talk to me then because she hated the questions I asked her. It was only after I just got elected mayor and we were at some function together, and I saw Thatcher. She came over and said, "You've got a lovely job. I'm really hopeful you'll do it well," and all that. I thought, isn't what you're saying about me 20 years ago?
I mean, had she got the right guy? but people do make mistakes. I'm surprised she was so warm.
I was amazed. I almost fell over. I mean, you abolished me. You did away with Londoners' right to elect their own council. And now you're praising me. I couldn't believe it. But she was very old by then. I'm not certain she was certain what she was saying.
No, perhaps not. Is Margaret Thatcher an idol for you, Anna? Is she someone that you try and emulate?
No, I mean, you can't take away from the fact that she was the first woman Prime Minister. And you can't take away the fact that she was the first woman to lead a political party. And she was, for women of my generation, it was amazing that somebody had achieved that. And as it happens, it was a Tory. And I think it does say a lot about the Labour Party, is that you've never even got close to it. And as a party, you need to work out and wonder why that is. And if I talk to some of the great Labour women MPs that there are at the moment, they actually think that their party's moving backwards, because it's a weird feature. And it always was when I was first involved in politics as a student, that the left, the hard left, has a problem with women.
No, we don't.
Well, why aren't there more women then in your part of the Labour Party than there are in the more moderate parts of it? And why is it that some brilliant Labour MPs like Jess Phillips talks about the fact she gets more abuse and more misogyny from the hard left, and as she puts it, than even the Tories? But why is that?
Myself, Jeremy, John McDonnell, all through our political careers, we fought for the rights of women. We encourage women to stand for local council elections, for the GLC, for Parliament. I mean, all the sort of campaigns about women's rights and things like that, left are totally committed to.
Well, it's all words, though. So why someone like Jess say that your side of the movement actually produces the misogyny? More than... Why does she think that? What is it about the hard left? Mm. Why haven't you got any women leaders even in the hard left? No, you haven't. It's interesting, isn't it? You,
people send all
Jeremy, John... three boys. Ah, Diane Abbott, yeah. Mm. Now, that's a good point. And there's one.
But there's a whole generation...
Diane Abbott.
Diane Abbott is absolutely ridiculed by the media and the right.
Mm. Yeah, but, I mean, lots of people are ridiculed. And
because she's on the left. We all get this crap.
But why...
You should have my life mate at the moment.
But why do you think, Ken, Labour's never had or come close to having a female leader?
I mean, I think we could possibly have had Harriet Harman. But you actually look back to the elections. There were so few women in Parliament back in the 60s and 70s on either side. Thatcher's breakthrough was amazing, given how few women MPs there were at that time.
Honestly, my party... Mm. We honestly,
but they didn't vote for her because she's a woman. They voted for her because she's right wing.
No,
they want to get rid of Edward Heath.
They voted for her because they thought she'd be the best leader. Mm. It's just like with May. She was, in fact, the choice was between her as a woman and Andrea Leadsom as a woman. Mm. And honestly, my party does not have as big a problem with women as I think your party does. You just have to look at the record to see that. You've got more women MPs, and one of the reasons...
Almost half.
And I had a great conversation with one of the Labour women backbenchers about that. And we were talking about how do we get more women in? Mm. And one of the things that Labour did, and I'm not saying I don't agree with it, I've got an open mind, was that they have all women lists. Yeah. And it has produced more women in Parliament. No debate about that.
We got almost half of Labour's MPs now women. But unless you do something like that, have all women lists, then it's very difficult.
See, because when I get abuse, and God, I get some great abuse. But, you know, when I get abuse from the left, one of the things that really surprises me is that they call out my sex. They call me a bitch and the C word. But your guys, John McDonnell, and even Jeremy, they will not condemn it.
Well, I'm sure if someone calls you a bitch... Jeremy will say that is wrong.
Unfortunately. And so Sarah Williston gets a coffin delivered.
Yeah.
And Jeremy says, well, you know, that's up to the local Labour Party. You know, they make their own decisions. And I think it would help him and politics generally if he actually had the balls to stand up and say, that is unacceptable. I don't care if it's a Conservative. See, you guys are much more tribal than we are.
No, we're not tribal.
Why doesn't Jeremy call
that
out?
All through our political careers, we have challenged all the sort of discrimination against women. It was people like Jeremy and me pushing Neil Kinnock to have all women shortlists. It was the right wing of the party that fought that. I mean, the left has always pushed to actually advance the rights of women in the Labour Party.
You don't deliver it, Lovey. That's
well,
the
we
most
did. We've got
delivery.
Almost half
well,
of our MPs
I think it was
women.
Tony Blair's leadership that delivered all women shortlists. But there are other... And I, as a member of staff, was threatened with legal action for imposing them on parts of the UK. But anyway, there are other issues as well with the modern Labour Party, Ken, and things that concern people about other people's views about certain things. At the moment, you are suspended from the Labour Party for precisely this thing. I can't remember when I worked for the party, and I joined the party when I was 15, I can't ever remember there being anti-Semitism. I just don't remember hearing it. Yeah. And yet, only under this leader has it been an issue. Why do you think that is?
Well, I've been in the party 48 years. I've never heard anyone say anything anti-Semitic. I mean, if you've got a bigotry, you're not going to join the Labour Party. And the simple fact is that, I mean, last year, 80 Jewish Labour Party members wrote a letter in The Guardian saying throughout all their years they'd never had either. This only arose 18 months ago when the contest for the youth candidate on Labour's NEC and the left-wing candidate, the Jeremy supporter, was denounced because Oxford Labour Club was alleged to have said things are anti-Semitic and so on. Before that, I'd never heard any Labour MP raise an issue of anti-Semitism in the party. And basically, from the moment Jeremy did so well at the election and MPs were stunned, they've all dropped this because it was to undermine Jeremy. It's not about anti-Semitism.
They might not be making noise about it. It doesn't mean it's not happening. And it doesn't mean that there aren't people that have joined the Labour Party that don't have these views. I mean, in terms of how people arrive at this sort of prejudice, is it that hard left people are more likely to buy into the idea that the world is controlled by a small amount of people? And is that how they get there? What is the route?
It's controlled by bankers. I mean,
but even then, people, you know, I've read comments online that people say that are just simply outrageous, that there are a lot of people on the hard left that believe that a small amount of Jewish people run the world.
I have never heard anyone on the hard left say anything anti-Semitic. They've criticised Israel. And if you look back at the big lie about what I'd said, I was asked on an interview about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I pointed out that in the 1930s, Hitler had done a deal with the German Zionists. No journalist took that up. It was only when John Mann, the Labour MP, 3 hours later, started screaming, "I'm Nazi apologist," and claiming I'd said Hitler was a Zionist. Well, if I'd said Hitler was a Zionist, I wouldn't just have apologised. I'd gone to my doctor to check it wasn't a sign of early dementia. How can anyone say a man who loathed and feared Jews all his life is a Zionist? But do you know what's so damning about our media? I never saw any article in a paper or anything on radio or television looking exactly what I'd said and challenging this crap. They just repeated it.
Well, there's been a lot of challenges to it, and I think a lot of people are aware of the history of the transfer agreement that was... people don't dispute that there was an early agreement and that some Jews were moved from Germany to that part of the world. What people dispute is your version of it, which is almost that Hitler was being helpful. And actually, anyone who's read Mein Kampf will know, and anyone who knows the basic history of Hitler, is that he had a deep psychopathic loathing. Yes. He was a deep, deep racist. So even if you are partially correct that there was an agreement to move some people rather than kill them, that wasn't done out of any respect or love. This was driving people out of the country they lived in. It's awful to...
But look,
represent it perhaps in the way that
all I said was that during the 1930s, Hitler supported Zionism, then he went mad and killed 6 million Jews.
But wasn't he... I mean, the fact that the first bit doesn't strike you as mad...
The simple fact is, it wasn't just that they'd... I mean...
He was mad before the Holocaust.
He did a deal because the German Zionists wanted all German Jews to go and live in what was Israel. And Hitler saw that as a way of getting Jews out, so that was the basis of the deal. But they went on. I mean, it was actual Eichmann who was overseeing the mass murder.
What I wonder is, did you, as an icon of the left, ever really want to end up in this position where you are trying to sort of argue a historical point that makes you sound like, to some extent, you're on the wrong side?
No. Go on.
Would you rather this hadn't happened?
No. If you look at the work of Francis Nicosa, who's the professor of Holocaust studies at the University of Vermont, who spent 40 years researching and writing about this, he spells out all the detail about the collaboration between German Zionists and the Nazis in the 1930s. And the term he uses is that there was widespread support in Hitler's government and the Nazi Party for the German Zionists. That's the term he uses, support.
Exactly.
Pardon?
What point are you trying to make about that?
Well, I didn't make this point. I mean, literally, I was asked to... No.
You just raised it. What's the point?
No, because you've all asked me about it.
No, you raised all this.
No,
this
I didn't raise
point.
It.
I mean, you sound like an apologist. That's the point. It sounds like...
I was asked a question on a radio, BBC radio programme.
No,
I answered it.
Just now you raised stuff. Oh, you must go and read this and read that. It's like you're trying to validate something which actually is hugely, deeply unpleasant and offensive, and it sounds like you're an anti-Semite.
No. Can I tell you this? I couldn't walk down the street in the weeks following my suspension without Jewish people coming up to me and saying, "We know what you said is true. What's all this about?"
Do you know what surprises me? I've just said, because if somebody said that to me, you sound like an anti-Semite, I'd want to go and punch them on the nose. And you haven't actually said, "How dare you say that about me?"
Because
I don't understand.
I've had to put up with 45 years of lies about what I say and do.
But you can't be satisfied with the way that this is going.
Well, no, basically, when we had the three-day hearing, and this was before Jeremy did so well at the general election, and the panel...
He did lose, love. Yeah. He lost the gentleman, somebody's just said, he lost the general election. And you know, and you know the other thing is the reason why people like Ruth Smeaton, Luciana and other people are not saying the things that they've had to suffer over years as Jewish people is because they are terrified now of your faction of the Labour Party deselecting them because they know momentum is coming for them. That is the reign of terror that your lot is yet again under... Well, it's like that in the Labour Party.
No, it's not like that. We've had the biggest influx of you people, mainly young people, 500,000 members now, more than any other party anywhere in Europe, because Jeremy is talking about making a better society.
You don't realise what's going on with the deselections of councillors, not just here in Harrogate, in London, but in cities like Nottingham, where moderate, decent Labour councillors who've served their communities for decades are leaving because they are being terrorised out by momentum. Yes, they are. You know how these people work.
Let me tell you the truth about this. Up until Blair... A local Labour Party could select any candidate it wanted. It was done locally. And that was the same for local councils as well, all of it. It was completely open and democratic. Blair brought in new rules that said if you're in a seat that was winnable, you had to choose from an approved list that the party machine had drawn up. So people like Tristram Hunt are parachuted into solid working class areas where that local party wasn't allowed to choose the local people they wanted. The same was done with councillors. I mean...
In Nottingham, they were parachuting in councillors.
No, no.
These are working class Labour
people. They parachuted in Tristram Hunt.
Yeah, but you said councillors as well.
You didn't let me finish what I was about to tell you.
All right, sorry.
Blair also introduced a vetting for existing councillors, and people who'd served on their local council for a decade were told, you don't have sufficient life skills to continue, and thousands were removed. So what we've done now is we're trying to get back to a situation where local Labour Party members can select the candidate they want, whether it's for Parliament or a local authority. That's what democracy is about.
So why are they leaving in Nottingham then? Why are they they're absolutely leaving? Decent, moderate, sensible Labour councillors are leaving because they know what's coming, because the party, their local party, has been infiltrated by hundreds of members who are going to get them out because they don't support your brand of socialism.
But that's what democracy is about. If I was in the Conservative Party...
No, my party, we don't do parachuting. That's the problem. No, you don't understand.
No, it's parachuting in. Local people have joined. They've got the right to choose a candidate whose politics they agree with. I mean, there must be a lot of people in your local party who don't agree with your politics. When I was Labour MP in Brent East, the right wing ran a candidate against me because they wanted someone who supported Kinnock, not me. I thought that was they should have the right to do that.
Let's just move on from the internal politics of the Labour Party. Ken, in April, you will be allowed to join the Labour Party again when your suspension is lifted. Firstly, do you think if you weren't Ken Livingstone, you'd have been expelled? And secondly, will you apply to rejoin the Labour Party?
No, no. I'm suspended. I've not been expelled. I mean,
yes, that's what I'm saying. But do you think, had you not been you with your
history, it's simply the fact that
you'd have been kicked out.
I had a very good lawyer there, Barrister Michael Mansfield, and I simply said to them, if you expel me, I'm going for judicial review. You haven't got a cat in hell's chance of winning that case because I simply stated historical fact and the party did nothing about all those MPs who lied. And so they didn't dare expel me. And it's because I'd said the truth.
Was it not that your relationship with Jeremy is such that he couldn't bear to see you go?
No, Jeremy had no say over all this. He inherited a machine staffed with Blairites, and that panel that does all the suspensions and expulsions is completely filled with people who came in under Blair. And it's not just me.
Well, they let Andrew Fisher work in the leader's office.
70,000 new members were being vetted and checked because they were trying to kick out lefties.
So will you rejoin in April?
Yeah, it just automatically happens.
So what happens if the day after you rejoin, someone asks you about this scenario again, and you repeat, as you have done tonight, the sort of things you've said, what Will you then be re-suspended, or will you then be expelled, or are you going to watch what you say after April?
No, I'm simply going to do what I've done all my political career. I have to answer your question truthfully. I mean, that's one of my problems, I suppose. I never went to Tony Blair's School for Duplicity and Evasion.
Well, hold on. I did. And let me tell you, it was a lovely school. Although, too many school dinners, I've got to lose a bit of weight. But, right, ladies and gentlemen, we will open up the floor to questions. The best three questions will play in a runoff to potentially win. Well, everyone who has to... Well, the top three will get a signed MP4 CD. Oh, no. And well, we'll play a game with MP4. So, if I can ask, one-sentence questions, please, and one-sentence answers. We'll try and get through as many as possible. So, if we can have hands in the air. Yes, the gentleman at the front. How do we solve a problem like Trump?
Well, certainly don't invite him for a bloody state visit. The simple fact is we're stuck with Trump unless he gets removed by Congress, and there are real dangers and real risks. But I suspect there's quite a lot of people in the Republican Party, very right-wing, in the House of Representatives and the Senate, are going to try and continue to constrain him. But it's the riskiest presidency of my lifetime.
I mean, I'm surprised you don't want to invite him for dinner, Ken. You've sat down with some interesting folk over there. Perhaps not extreme enough.
The real answer to this, I think, it is to make sure he doesn't get re-elected. And to make sure of that, you've got to cure the problems that caused him to get elected.
I personally want him to get re-elected because he's going to keep my career alive.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And let me just say, it is an honour to be here. And not only in this beautiful city of London, but tonight in front of 30,000 people. It's a real honour to be here.
Okay, the gentleman right at the back.
How do you deal with the Irish border question?
How do you deal with the Irish border question?
Easy peasy, customs union, single market, sorted. It's absolutely, customs union sorts the problem.
Customs union?
And British business would be so pleased, and the British public even more pleased, because it would be sorted, and then we can get on and do everything else we need to do.
I agree.
Okay, any more? For any more? Yes, the lady at the front.
If Sadiq Khan does come to you and ask for advice, what advice, what's your top thing that you want to do?
If Sadiq comes to you for advice, Ken, what would be your number one piece of advice?
It's the thing he's doing. He's brought back the low emission zone proposals, so he's going to tackle the air quality problem in London. Now, I do remember the exact figure now, 40,000 people dying every year. And it's appalling. It isn't just people who are dying. It's kids growing up with permanently damaged lungs. And, I mean, the idea of this government just doesn't do a damn thing. They've lost 3 court cases for it. They just don't want to stand up to the motor lobby.
Did you see today when somebody asked him that question? Yeah. And they said, it must be marvellous that you've come home. And he said, nah, mate. He said, I'm from South London. I thought that was wonderful. Because he's in Pakistan, isn't he, or in India. And I thought it was a lovely answer he gave.
It was a great answer.
He's good. He's all right, Sadiq. He's a good man.
Yes, the gentleman over there.
Who's Britain's answer to Macron?
In a name, Anna Soubry.
So you think Chuka Anna is rather... the lovely Chuka.
The lovely Chuka.
I love Chuka.
Ken?
Chuka. That's the end of Chuka's career. Please do not tweet that out, for God's sake. You know, the guy... actually, his majority is so huge, he's safe from momentum even.
The lovely John McDonnell.
John McDonnell is... That is one heck of a theory. And the final question to the gentleman in the middle. How does Labour win when it needs to get Tory votes at the next election?
We had the biggest increase in the Labour vote since 1945. I mean, 40% Labour, 42.5% Tory. Yes, but there's one simple fact. If the Tories had lost 7 more seats, Jeremy would be leading a minority government.
Yeah, but to get those 7...
And well, but the simple fact is, if Labour MPs had spent 18 months not undermining Jeremy and trying to get rid of him, but out there campaigning for his policies, if the party machine had actually been working to build for the election rather than trying to get rid of 70,000 lefties, we would have won this election.
We all
and I think we will win the next one.
So, in short,
It's Tony Blair's fault. Right. Okay, so I'm the best things. Three questions were the one from the lady at the front, the one from the gentleman next to you, and the Macron question. So if you three people would like to join us up on stage... Oh, come on, give him a round of applause. Come on, it's Christmas. Gentlemen, please. And we give it up for our guests, Ken Livingston and Anna Soubry. Thank you very much. I'll catch you backstage. Cheers, Ken, thank you. Right, this is the denouement. This is the final part of the night. So what we're going to do, we're going to play a quick game. And we're going to play a quick game of Name That Tune. So when you hear an intro, the audience can help. The first one to shout out gets the prize. And the first prize tonight, or the first prize available, is a lovely bottle of Fleury with a signed copy of the MP4 album Cross Party. Well, everyone gets one of them anyway, so you might as well. There you go. You can, there you go.
Others are available at the back of the hall.
A few rare unsigned copies.
£5 each.
Okay, so to name this tune for a bottle of Fleury. Take it away, fellas. Yes, called it. Called it. Driving over Christmas. It's a bottle of Fleury. That was very quick. Well done. Merry Christmas. So here we go for the second one. Stop the... It was. Jenna Lewis, stop the cavalry. You shout it out. Right, this is for the big prize. A bottle of champagne. You've really got to try and win this, and then it's all fair. It's the socialist... Giving out a bottle of champagne is the socialist utopia we all want to live in. Right, okay. Oh, so the clue for this one. This was a hit this year. It's not necessarily a festive hit, but it was a big hit this year. So here we go. Said the right answer. For those of you that didn't recognise it, this is how it sounds with the lyrics.
Accountability with conservative delivery. Make sure this time you get it right. Vote for Greg Knight. Vote Greg Knight.
Woohoo! There you go. That all worked out well. Congratulations to our winners. Merry Christmas. Thank you for coming. Cheers. Well done. Well done. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that almost brings us to the end, but it wouldn't be a Christmas political party without some music. But please, firstly, thank you all for coming. The political party next year is sold out almost for the whole year. There are a few tickets left for some of the shows at the other palace, but the first guest of the year in January, James Cleverly. In February, Ed Miliband. Oh, no. And in March, Angela Rayner, and more to be booked later in the year. Some big names that I will confirm soon. But thank you for coming tonight, and we will end with, by all means, get up and dance. But thank you for coming tonight. Please, before we do go, give it up for Anna Soubry and Ken Livingston, for all the staff here at the Leicester Square Theatre, who works out tonight, for MP4, and it's Christmas, so let's have a sing and a dance with the wonderful MP4. Well, there you go. Anna Soubry and Ken Livingston. I hope you enjoyed the interview. The political party returns next year in January with James Cleverly, in February with Ed Miliband, and in March with Angela Rayner. Tickets for those shows have already sold out. There's a handful of tickets left for some of the shows next year, but it's pretty much sold out until November. But always check on the Other Palace website. Sometimes there are late returns on the day, so check my Twitter feed as well, at Matt Ford. I'll always retweet people who are maybe can't make the show on the Wednesday and are trying to offload the tickets at short notice, so do check that. If you could leave us a review on iTunes, it'd be very good of you, I'd be very grateful. And if you could share this link with your friends and your family, again, I'd be very grateful. And I hope you have a Merry Christmas. I'm genuinely... a fan of Christmas and love it. So wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope you enjoy a bit of time off. If you do get a bit of time off, and just have some mulled wine and some pie, some turkey. I mean, I don't know why I put pie ahead of turkey there, but says a lot about what I've been eating lately. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and I shall see you soon. Ta-ra.